We're in this wisdom series. If you're just joining us and you're like, I don't know who Brian is. I don't know what Crossroads Anywhere is. I don't even know where the Dayton Dragons are. I'm so confused right now. It's okay. It's okay. We're glad you're with us. You're joining us, so you know, in the last part of a wisdom series. We got this week and next week. We've been looking at the wisdom literature in the Bible. That's what that video just talked about. Primarily, that's Proverbs, Job, and Ecclesiastes from the Old Testament. And today, we're asking, what does it look like to find and apply God's wisdom to the most complex problems and issues in our life and in our world? The ones that we're like, I have no idea how to handle this. You ever have a situation like that in your life? Maybe you have one right now. I did just a few weeks ago. I was supposed to actually start this whole wisdom series, kick off the whole thing. I was so excited about it. And then I got sick, and Paco had to fill in for me. Anybody remember that? By the way, Paco, great job. Thank you. This is amazing, amazing, amazing. I don't know what you would say if someone was like, hey, in like, I don't know, basically 2 hours, can you go talk to tens of thousands of people about the Bible, just kind of off the cuff? And he was like, sure. That's what he said. It was amazing. Amazing. Now, that week, you know I got sick, but you don't know what happened before. What happened before it was this complex situation where I was like, I'm in over my head. I do not know what to do. Now, to understand, I got to back you up a little bit all the way to the Flying Pig Marathon. My wife runs a marathon. She ran the Flying Pig. And in the Flying Pig, she had hip pain, had to stop running. That's not really great. We took her to the doctor the next day, and they diagnosed her with a fractured hip. That's bad. Said she's on crutches for 6 weeks, which is really tough. If you've ever been an adult and on crutches, you know this, but you basically can't carry anything. You can't take cups of water or coffee to the couch. You can't do anything, so it's just really rough. Now, the week before I was supposed to teach, that's the Sunday, the week before, on the Wednesday, she was supposed to get off crutches. She was going to go back to the doctor. That's what they had told us, 6 weeks, ends on Wednesday. And so on the Monday before that Wednesday, we decide now is the right time to get a puppy. Allow me to help you for a minute. If in your life you're thinking, is now the right time to get a puppy? No. No, it is never the right time to get a puppy. Ever. Unless you're like, I want a toddler with teeth that's faster than me. It's basically a puppy. I'm like, right, I got 2 days. I can handle Monday to Wednesday. I can handle the puppy by myself, right? All I got to do is make it to Wednesday. But on Wednesday, Sarah goes back to the doctor and they say, actually 4 more weeks on crutches. I know, you feel so bad for me, right? Rough. Thursday night, Gracie wakes up sick. She's puking in the middle of the night. I'm up all night with her. Friday, I think we're okay. I think we've passed it. I'm working on my message. I'm getting ready. Saturday morning hits, and within about an hour, Ben, Eli, and Sarah all start just erupting. Just, that's all I can, it's like Barfenheimer, you know, if it was a movie. Just explosions. I don't know what to do. I'm doing my best, right? I got the dog peeing on the carpet. I got 3 people puking. So this is what I did. I don't know. This is what I did. I was like, Sarah, you're upstairs. There's a bathroom up there. You can crutch your way as fast as you can to that. That's the best we got. You know, Eli, you can have the middle floor. There's a bathroom there. My only request, this will matter later, do not puke on the couch. Make it off the couch. Make it to the toilet. That's all I ask. And then Ben, I put Ben in the basement. There's no bathroom down there, so I found a red bucket, and I gave it to him, and I said, I'll be by every once in a while to empty it. This is that bucket. I took this picture yesterday. It's by the hose because I'm planning on cleaning it out. Someday. Now, I think I'm handling it. Like, I think I'm managing it, right? I'm like doing the barf, and then the puppy pees in the rug, and I clean up the puppy stuff, and I'm doing all this stuff. And then about 6:30, Eli has to puke. And so he jumps off the couch, and he makes it about a step and a half, and then it just boom. But he doesn't stop. He just keeps running. 30 feet. A trail is just blazed. It's horrible. The dog starts trying to eat it. I'm like, no! Why did I get a puppy? So I get the paper towels. They're out. I get the bath towel. I'm just trying to clean it up, you know, and I get the shot the dog, and I finally get it cleaned up about 7:30, and I stand up, and I'm like, okay, I think I made it. Oh, no. Oh, and then it happens. Just erupts. Awful, awful. Now, the question I've gotten asked the most when I tell this story to people who don't want to hear it, which is the only kind I've found so far, is Kyle, was it like both ends? You know, was it both ends? Yeah, it was. Now, you might be sitting there going, what does that have to do with wisdom exactly, the series that we're in? First couple things. One, maybe when you're thinking, is the right time to get a puppy? The answer is no. Okay, don't get a puppy ever. Two, red buckets really work in a pinch. And three, if you're ever sick and you need someone to fill in you at work, call Paco, because that worked for me. Okay, and then lastly, I know that there are places in our lives, right? We all feel this way, in over our heads. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to solve it. And for a lot of us, those places and those situations are much more serious and long-lasting than a bone that's going to heal or a stomach bug that you're going to get over in a few days. They're issues that we've been wrestling with for weeks, for months, sometimes for years. They're these big problems, the complex places, the places where you go, God, if you have wisdom and I could have some, I sure would like it in this situation in my life, the complex ones. There's kind of two types of these, as a by the way. There's the external complexities in the world that we as the church are actually called to. I don't know if you knew that. It says it in this book. If you haven't picked one of these up yet, definitely get it. It's super, super cool, super interesting. And I love what it says right inside the cover. It says, why we go. When it comes to solving the big problems of injustice, poverty, and exploitation, people often think that someone else will step in. Congrats, your name is someone else. See, this is what God says to the church. He says these massive, complex problems that governments can't solve, that no one knows how to deal with, that's actually your business to go run after. It's like, whoa, how? How would I do that? And then there's the internal ones, the ones that are inside of our lives, inside of our homes, you know, from what career should I choose, what college should I go to, what major should I pick, to who should I date, to how do I know when to get married, how do I know who the right one is, to what do I pick for a career, to is it time to switch careers, to should I have kids, how do I parent a 2-year-old, what about a 12-year-old, what about my 16-year-old who's dealing with problems I've never dealt with in my life, how do I handle these situations? And I find these are the places where we get stuck in life. We can end up paralyzed, not knowing what to do, because the complexity is just overwhelming. And the world's not helping us with this. See, the world is actually an increasingly complex and constantly changing place, and it hasn't always been that way. The world's always been somewhat complicated, and sociologists are starting to recognize this and explain it this way. They say, complicated is kind of like a car engine. You know, there's lots of parts, but it's understandable. You could become a mechanic, and you could get how it works together. This gear turns this one, and it has this predictable kind of pattern to it. And so if there's a problem, you can diagnose the problem, and you can figure out what to do, how to solve it. But that's not the world anymore. Now the world is complex. It's so interconnected that when you pull on one thread, it pulls on 100 others. We know this. Think about the gas pump for a minute. At the gas pump, why are gas prices the price they are? Well, it's because there's a Russian dictator who's invading a country none of us could place on a map only 2 years ago. The Saudis started a golf league, and there might be a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico next week. Maybe. We're not sure, right? There's this interconnected, complex world. One of my favorite thinkers on leadership is a guy named General Stanley McChrystal. He led the Joint Task Force in the war in Afghanistan, and that was kind of the tipping point where warfare went from complicated to complex. 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, it's complicated, but somewhat predictable. We get to this point, and because of technology and communication ability, all of a sudden, it's wildly unpredictable. And so he wrote this book called Team of Teams, kind of giving leadership lessons on how to think about, understand, come to term with, and deal with this complexity. He wrote this: the technological changes of recent decades have led to a more interdependent and fast-paced world. This creates a state of complexity. Complexity produces a fundamentally different situation from the complicated challenges of the past. Complicated problems required great effort, but ultimately yielded to prediction. Complexity means that, in spite of our increased abilities to track and measure, the world has become, in many ways, vastly less predictable. Isn't it interesting? So many more of us now feel stuck in some of these big questions. What's my purpose in life? What career should I pursue? Who should I marry? Than ever before, despite the fact that we have more access to expert knowledge than ever before. You can go on YouTube and watch videos until you die about any topic you want to know about. You can read articles, you can access data, you can sort through all of it, and yet many of us are still stuck in these places and problems. Now, in contrast to this increasingly complex and constantly changing world, the Bible presents never-changing, incredibly simple wisdom. Here's an example from the book of Proverbs. This may be the most famous proverb. It's certainly in the top 5 or 10. Proverbs 3, 5 to 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, and all your ways submit to him, and he will make your paths straight. Now, the unchanging part's pretty clear, right? I mean, that hasn't changed in 3,000 years since it was written. And Job, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, all about 3,000 years old. In fact, the newest wisdom in the Bible, the stuff that Jesus said, the stuff in the New Testament, that's 2,000 years old. Hasn't changed at all since. That means it doesn't know about our modern culture. It doesn't know about the current geopolitical environment. It doesn't know about Twitter or Threads or TikTok. It doesn't know about democracy, capitalism, postmodernism, Post Malone. Nothing. Knows nothing about it. It's unchanging. But did you also know how simple it is? See, it's incredibly, radically, ridiculously even simple. In the advertising world, there's this kind of common knowledge about 7 words or less. And the idea is if you want to get your message communicated, your brand promise to people, you have to communicate it in 7 words or less. Your slogan, your billboard, whatever. If you use more than that, that approves. People will just ignore your message. Has to be 7 words or less. And so I was curious with Proverbs. How many words is the average proverb? I skipped 1 through 9 because that's kind of like the introduction to Proverbs. They're not really structured the way that the classic proverb chapters are. So I took Proverbs chapter 10, our classically structured proverb chapter, and I counted the words. And guess how many words the average proverb has? No, not 7. It's actually 16.3. And then I remembered something, though. The Bible wasn't written in modern English. It was written in ancient Hebrew. So I went back to the ancient Hebrew, and I counted again. And guess how many words the average proverb has in its original language? 6.85. It's fascinating. It's so simple. And a reasonable question to ask, isn't it foolish to rely on such simple, unchanging wisdom when facing the problems of the modern world or increasingly complex, constantly changing world? Isn't that silly? And I bring this up because I think this is how it feels to us. And so it's worth vocalizing that feeling, vocalizing that question, because we just tend to ignore it when it feels so simple. As a pastor, I get to counsel people from time to time. They'll come to me with problems and questions. And by the time you get to me, it's not like a low level, like, hey, man, I was just kind of casually wondering about. It's like, my life's on fire. I don't know what to do in this situation. What do I do? And they always start with that. They're like, I just have no idea what God would want me to do. And can I tell you that almost 100 times out of 100 when I sit down with them, yes, they do. They do. I rarely ever give them insight into the Bible they haven't heard before. They already know it. It's just so simple that they're discounting it, completely overlooking at it. Today I have one goal. It's just to convince you, hopefully, that God's unchanging simple wisdom is actually the only thing that can give you stability and help you through the most important challenges of your life. It's the only thing. You can think about it like an ice skater. You watch the Olympics, you know, the ice skaters, they rotate fast and fast, around and around and around and around and around, and you're like, how do they possibly stay upright? Well, the trick is you pick a simple, unchanging spot to focus on, and you don't take your eyes from it. And no matter what happens, what craziness swirls around, you remain balanced. That's the wisdom of God for us. That's the wisdom of God. See, the myth of wisdom, I think, is that wisdom equals the ability to understand complexity. That if I were truly wise, I would be able to look at an issue in my life, understand every angle, analyze everything, get all the expert inputs, put it all together, put it into a math formula, and somehow know exactly what to do. The thing that I'll not just be happy of with this year, but 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now. That's what wisdom is, understanding complexity. Well, not in the Bible. That's not what it is. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus gives the longest section of wisdom, uninterrupted, that he ever gave, or at least that we have recorded. It's called the Sermon on the Mount. And sermon's a little bit misleading because it makes you think that it's kind of one themed thing, you know, 45 minutes, an hour, I don't know how long, on one topic. That's not what it is. I actually think it's Jesus giving us his Proverbs. It lines up really well with the way Proverbs are structured. It's kind of like little nuggets of wisdom after little nuggets of wisdom, like just thing after thing. It's a lot of his most classic teaching that's 100% original to him is in this one section, the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit. The idea of being salt and light. The call to go the extra mile, to love your enemies, to not judge, to not worry. The call to follow the narrow way versus the broad path, and a whole bunch more. They're all kind of packed in there. And not coincidentally, at the end of this whole section, Jesus goes directly to the main contrast of all wisdom literature, which is the wise versus the fool. So the Bible sets out this picture. It says, we will, you and I, end up either as wise or as a fool. There is no middle ground. No, there's nothing here. And I think most of us wish that that was the case. Most of us, we don't want to be a fool, but we're not necessarily willing to do what it would take to be wise because of the high call of the Bible. And so we just try to land here, but that's not an option. You'll become one or the other. This is how Jesus ends the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat in that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat in that house, and it fell. And great was its fall. Jesus says the dividing line between the wise and the fool is not the person who understands all complexities. The person who's done the detailed analysis, researched everything thoroughly, gets all of it, considered every angle, that's not it. And it's not the person who treated these statements, love your enemies, as like book titles. Oh, what an interesting idea to explore at a later time with more depth. He says it's the people who took what he just said and actually apply them, actually start trying to do them. See, the wisdom of God is oftentimes seven words or less. In fact, in my life, when it's come to those key moments, I can say I've never heard more than seven words, ever. And I've waited. God, are you going to give me more? No, not until you act on these. This is the wisdom of God in the Bible. And if that seems backwards, why would God equip us to confront this complex world and this complex problem with such simple wisdom? Isn't that backwards? I would say, yeah, it's totally backwards. Totally backwards. But should we expect anything else from the God who said, if you want to be first, you got to be last? The God who said, if you want to save your life, you got to lose it? The God who looked at the world and said, this place needs rescued, and rather than send some giant warrior, sends a baby born in a barn in a nowhere place in a nowhere corner of the world. That's the God of the universe. He confounds the wise of this age. And he says, if you want to enter into my kingdom, you've got to become like a child. I took my kids to Kings Island recently, the amusement park up north of here, and they'd never been there before. That's my bad as a dad. I was just dragging my heels. So we finally took them there, and I made them this deal, right? I was like, hey, whatever roller coaster you want to go on, whatever ride you want to go on, I will go on it with you. For the record, I have no personal need to ride any of these things. I did that once in my life. It was great. I'm over it now, you know? And so we go in there, and they immediately see this new ride. It's called the Soul Spinner. Have you heard of the Soul Spinner? Okay, so it's like a carousel. It goes around, only if it went a billion miles an hour and also vertical instead of horizontal. It's like you take a roller coaster, cut off everything but the loop, and they just do the loop again and again and again and again and again. It's like that, you know? And they're like, that one, we want to ride that one. It's like, oh, okay. I would like some more information about it first, actually. It's brand new. You know, how do we know it's safe? Maybe we should just kind of, you know, let's watch some people ride it first and see about their, do they look happy, you know? That's what I was thinking. But my kids are like, let's get in line, let's go. Let's go. So you think a lot of us are in this spot as adults where we want more information. There's this massive temptation to balk at the simple wisdom of God until we know more. But I just want to warn you about something. If you're waiting to act in your life, I don't know what that complex situation is. I don't know if it's get married or not get married. I don't know if it's switch careers or not. I don't know if it's go on the trip, don't go on the trip. I don't know what it is for you. But I'm telling you, if you're waiting for complete information before acting on the simple wisdom of God, you will never, ever get it, ever. The Bible has a promise about knowledge. It comes in 1 Corinthians 13. It says, "For we know in part, and we prophesy in part." Prophesy means our ability to look beyond this moment into the future. Our ability to see that is partial right now. "For now, we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I'm fully known." Paul, who wrote this, he says, look, a time is coming when you will have full knowledge. How awesome is that? It's just not going to be in this life. So don't wait for it. That's why the proverb says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. And all your ways submit to him. He will make your path straight." Does anything in that proverb sound like, make sure you understand every angle? Make sure you've done your homework, you know? I think that's how we treat it. We would like to know more before we move, but God kind of says, you're not going to know more until you move. This is the story of me coming to Crossroads, and this is the story, honestly, of people who I respect in their life, who've made big decisions, who've gotten through complexities and have a life that I would want, all have these common stories in their life where they say they reach a moment where the simple wisdom of God would almost be compelling them to take a step that felt like stepping off a cliff. And the moment of decision was, will I step or not? Will I trust in the Lord with all of my heart, or will I lean backwards on my own understanding? This is the story of me coming to Crossroads years and years ago. I had a great corporate career and a great path planned for me, but I felt like God was telling me, literally, move to Cincinnati. That's it. And I was like, cool. That's the start of a conversation. Why? To do what? And as I prayed about this, as I sat on it, the sense I got from God is, I'm not going to tell you what until you go where. I gave you enough to get moving. Go. Get there. You'll figure it out. And so I told people in my life, wise counsel, I said, hey, this is the call that I'm feeling. I think I'm supposed to go into ministry. I think God's saying, put my job, move to Cincinnati. What do you think? And they were like, yeah, that sounds like the right thing to do. And I was like, okay, maybe I said something wrong. I don't have a job there. I don't know what I'm going to do there. That was the moment. Move, go. And I had to decide, will I step off the cliff or not? Will I trust God or will I lean back on my own understanding? When I taught my kids to swim, I took them to my parents' pool. They have like a classic kind of diving board that goes out, you know? And I would take them all to the end of the diving board. I put them on the diving board, and then I would get in the water like this. And I go, okay, just jump. Go ahead. And all of them did the same thing. Maybe your kids, they walked to the edge and they were like, okay, actually, Dad, a couple questions first. Just checking. So you're going to catch me. Yes, I'm totally going to catch you. You're not going to let me go underwater. I will sure attempt to not let you go underwater. If you do a little bit, I'll pull you right back up. It's going to be just fine. Okay. I just want to review that one more time. You're going to catch, like, it was just like that every time, right? This hesitancy. And I think about some of us in this room. We're in that moment of our life where we're on the end of the diving board. And God's in the water like, okay, come on, let's go. And we're like, I got a couple questions. I just want to make a couple questions for you. And it can feel like, isn't this wise, you know? Isn't it wise to make sure that we really are supposed to follow these directions of God? Isn't it wise to wait on the Lord? That's in the Bible. And it is. It's actually in the Bible all over the place. But I'll tell you, as I've been researching and digging into this and talking to other pastors, I've yet to find a single place where there's an example of somebody in the Bible who God calls to wait until they get more information. You won't find that scene. What you will find are verses like this one in Isaiah 40, 31. It says, but those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. See, the word wait in Hebrew is kavah, and it doesn't have connotations of stillness. It actually has connotations of activity, of motion. There's this forward-leaning anticipation and excitement in it. Henry Nouwen is a famous Dutch Catholic theologian who wrote about this concept of waiting. And he says the best picture for understanding it is actually the trapeze in the circus. So one day the circus came to town. He saw the trapeze act, and he was like, man, this is really cool. I want to understand it. And so he befriended the guy who ran the troupe, a guy named Rodley, and just asked him questions about how it works. And Rodley told him, in the trapeze act, there's two roles. There's the flyer, the person who jumps, and then there's the catcher. This is their conversation. How does it work, I asked. The secret, Rodley said, is that the flyer does nothing and the catcher does everything. When I fly to my catcher, Joe, I have simply to stretch out my arms and hands and wait for him to catch me and pull me safely over the apron behind the catch bar. You do nothing? I said, surprised. Nothing, Rodley repeated. The worst thing the flyer can do is try to catch the catcher. I'm not supposed to catch Joe. It's Joe's task to catch me. If I grab Joe's wrist, I might break them, or he might break mine, and that'd be the end of both of us. A flyer must fly, and a catcher must catch. And the flyer must trust, with outstretched arms, that his catcher will be there for him. The flyer does nothing. You just wait. You jump. You hope with outstretched hands. God, would you catch me? If you have yet to have a moment in your life where it's felt like that, God, I'm following you in this, I think, I hope, then you have yet to experience the fullness of faith. There's more for you. You have yet to move. There's wisdom of God that could compel you forward. Job 11, one of our pieces of wisdom literature, says, surrender your heart to God, stretch out your hands to him. It's that picture, the same exact picture. And if you think about that in motion, kind of I'm waiting for you to catch me and get me moving thing, all of a sudden Isaiah 40:31 reads differently. But those who wait in the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. God says, if you'll trust me, if you'll take the leap, I have a promise for you. Either you're going to fly, you're going to run, or you're going to walk. He says, for some of you, if you'll trust me, if you'll take the leap, I will catch you in midair and I will enable you to fly right over that problem. You will be amazed how fast it passes. You'll be amazed how fast I get you through it. Others of you, you're not going to fly over it. That's not what I have for you. But when I catch you in motion, we're going to set you down and you're going to run right through that thing like a bulldozer. He says, others of you, you won't be able to fly over it. You're not going to run through it, but I promise I will catch you, I will set your feet firmly on a straight path, and you will walk through it, and you will not stumble. This is the promise of God to the wise. This is the dot I want to connect to you. The wise. See, if you're doing something and following God in wisdom, it's going to feel like foolishness to the world, but it's wisdom to God. It's wisdom. That verse doesn't say, but those who wait on the Lord shall keep doing their research until they find the right answer. But those who wait on the Lord shall eventually hear a magical voice that tells them what to do with certainty. But those who wait on the Lord shall one day earn more treasure in heaven for being cautious. Doesn't say that. Doesn't say it. You know, I got to talk at one of our college nights, actually a few of them at Uptown back in the spring, and it was such amazing interactions, and some of them I just did open Q&A. Hey, just kind of ask me anything. And a lot of the questions you get from college students are the things you might expect, these kind of big questions, you know. What should I major in? And I don't know if I should stay here. And how do I know what job to pick? And I've been dating this person. And I don't know if we should get married or not. And how do you know? And what's my purpose in life? All these monumental, complex issues, right? And one kid at the end of it, he asked me this question that I love. He said, how do you know that you're making the right decision? I said, oh, man, That's a great question. You don't. That's a life of faith. It's not called certainty for a reason. See, I think that what we want is wisdom to be insurance against the need for faith. That's what we want. I won't need faith. I won't ever be in that vulnerable position where I trust God to catch me because I'm just going to have enough wisdom that I'm going to see it from every angle. I'll be certain of the right course of action, and then I'll move. I won't need any faith. It's not what wisdom is. And if that's how you live your life, you will never, ever follow God. And I'm just telling you, you will miss out on him. You miss out on the beauty and the wonder and the adventure of him. God's call is to go before we know everything. Go. You won't have all the information. You got to move anyway. As a church, I think that's been one of our strengths, actually. And if I'm honest, it probably is what drew me to Crossroads most in the first place. I saw a church who was acting, who was going. As a college student, I had heard about the AIDS epidemic in South Africa, which at that time was this giant humanitarian crisis, this big thing. No one really knew how to deal with it. Churches weren't doing a great job. It was scary because if you caught the disease, it could still kill you at that point. It was this massive thing. But when I read my Bible, which I started doing more seriously as a college student, I came across this one passage that was somewhat frustrating, but also convicting to me. In the passage, Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. It was five words. And then these really complex thinkers, the Pharisees, who had studied every word and interpretation and all this stuff, were like, hey, we got a question for you. Who is my neighbor? Ha ha, right? And Jesus is like, your neighbor, basically, this is my interpretation, anybody you know that needs help. That's it. And so I felt this conviction of wanting to help, wanting to do something. I didn't know everything. I didn't know how to help. I didn't know what to do. But then I heard about Crossroads, who was building the largest privately funded AIDS hospice and sending 300 people on the first ever go trip to help open it, and I went. This is a picture of me and Sarah on that first ever go trip from years and years and years ago. Amazing. And to say this trip changed my life is an understatement. When we went on this trip, she was Sarah Lord. 5 months later, she was Sarah Ranson. That's how significant that trip was in our marriage story. I didn't know that. I couldn't plan that. If I was drawing a straight path for my life, I would have never put that in there. I would have never guessed. I just went and I followed God. That's it. That's the life of faith. And in the summer of 2021, our board asked me to go to the border of the U.S. and Mexico border and see what was happening. Check out the border crisis, similar to that situation. See if there's anything our church could do to help. Now, I knew nothing. I had very little information to go on. This is how little. I got to the airport, I got through security, got to my gate, got out my phone, and Googled border crisis, question mark? You know, I'm trying to make sure no one else sees me. Yeah, I know a lot about this. I get down there, and everyone used the same word that we've been talking about today, complexity. It's so complex, it's so complex, it's so complex. And it really is, you know. When I was down there, I talked to the assistant of director of the Rio Grande Valley District, which is the most heavily trafficked by far section of our border. I went on a patrol with border agents. I took a ride in the Rio Grande with armed guards, watched the cartel shuttle people across the river, talked to migrants on both sides. And it's very complex. Because you have all these parties with all these agendas meeting in this one place. And in the middle of it all, though, were the people. Like Anna, who I met in a migrant camp in Reynosa, Mexico. Anna was a pharmacist in a Central American country. And the cartel moved into her town and started to exploit her. Small at first, hey, you need to pay us to keep you safe. And then every month they'd step it up, pay a little bit more, pay a little bit more, until she was giving them everything. And the point at which she was giving them everything, they came to her and they said, you need to give us more or we will kill you and your entire family. She's like, I don't have any more. And they said, we'll be back next week. And so Anna did what you and I might do. She didn't want to leave. This was her home. She packed up and she fled north with her 7-year-old daughter in tow. By the way, the only way she could pay to get north was to sell her body. Painful, horrible, right? Devastating. And when I talked to people like Anna, I just got angry. Why isn't government doing anything? You know, they could do something. The Mexican government, these people on Mexican soil, they could do something. The U.S. government, they could send supplies across or something. I don't know. What about business? There's plenty of money in business on both sides of the river. Why can't somebody do something to help them? Or what about the Red Cross? Why aren't they here? I just got angry. And then in his wisdom, God put those five words back into my head. Love your neighbor as yourself. And then six more words. It's your job, not theirs. That's it. That's it. And so our team, we went to investigate. We came back with this conviction. Not the knowledge on what to do. Not all of the information gathered. Not even close to it. But a conviction that what it would mean to follow God would be to step into this problem and see if we can help. And so for the past couple years, that's what we've been doing. Just looking. How can we help? Could we do this? Could we do that? And I'm so pleased to tell you that we've relooked at some of our work in those Central American countries where people flee from. We've determined that what those folks really want, this is what they'll tell you in those migrant camps, is they don't want to leave home. Just like you don't want to leave your home. They want to stay. And so we said, man, the thing we could start with is how do we make home a place they never have to leave? How can we invest where they are? And so we've been looking at that with Nicaragua, work we've had going for a while. And I'm so pleased to announce to you that we're adding a new country, Guatemala. Check this out.
So some people might be wondering why Guatemala. This part of the world, known as the Western Highlands, is one of the most afflicted areas with poverty in the entire world. See, this area is full of not just any type of poverty, but systematic and generational poverty. And one of the things that combats that type of poverty is education. See, when you are living in poverty, you don't have access to education, you don't have good jobs, and you don't have really a way to get out of that systematic and generational poverty. And so we've partnered with an organization down here in Guatemala that is looking to change that narrative. See, 1 in 3 Guatemalans are illiterate. And that number actually used to be 2 in 3 Guatemalans are illiterate, because we know that when folks have education, when people have access to education, when people have access to technology, they can have better careers, they can have better jobs, and we can change the narrative of this generational poverty that exists here. We're coming alongside an organization that wants to go. And Crossroads is so excited to be a part of that going, because we know that we really can change the world. And so our partner down here is doing things like handing out books. Students are going to school on scholarship and learning more and more each day. And they're getting more and more access. And they're taking that access, and not only are they giving it to their families, but they're raising families with this newfound intelligence, with this newfound education, and it's changing Guatemala. And we cannot believe that we get to be a part of it. And I'll tell you what, some of the work that we've been doing, it's not been easy. It's been hard. It's been a little bit intense. And maybe if you come here, you'll see how intense some of the situations are. But it is powerful. It's powerful to see what folks can do when they come together. It's powerful to see what people can do when they have access. And it's powerful to see what we can do when we come alongside someone who's already doing something great. And we're going to do it great too, because we believe God has empowered us to change the world.
Mi nombre es Jocelyn y estoy estudiando para ser contadora.
Mi nombre es Ana. Gracias al programa de beca puedo convertirme en una gran enfermera.
Cuando crezca quiero ser doctora.
De grande sueño ser un músico profesional.
Puedo ser programadora.
Sueño con ser odontóloga profesional.
Sueño con convertirme en contadora.
Yo quiero ser una odontóloga profesional graduándome de la universidad.
Quiero ser de grande maestra para que puedas enseñarles a los docentes sobre lo que me enseñan a mí.
I don't know where in your life God's calling you with wisdom. Maybe it's to another country, maybe it's to go on a trip, or maybe it's an internal issue in your life. Maybe it's he's calling you to the trouble in your marriage to finally do something about it. Maybe he's calling you to get closer to your kid, that one who you just don't connect with at all. Maybe he's calling you to rethink your career choices. I don't know what it is, the big complex problem. I just promise he's going to send you into it with simple instructions. Now, I know there may be one last objection you have. You might be going, Kyle, I get it. I'm not going to know everything, and God's not really going to be okay with me just waiting, knowing something but not doing anything with it. That seems obvious. But Kyle, I don't have what I need. I don't have what I need to repair my marriage. I don't have what I need to help my 16-year-old with the problem. I just don't understand. I don't have what I need. I can't do it. What do you say to that? I'll tell you what Jesus said. In Luke 10, he sent out 70 disciples. The first time he sent a big group of people to go tackle the problems in the world. Here were his instructions. Luke 10:3, go your way. Behold, I send you out as lambs among wolves. Carry neither money bag, knapsack, nor sandals. Greet no one on the road. Jesus says, hey, I'm sending you out into danger. If you sense that part, if fear is going, whoa, that looks dangerous, you're right. In fact, it's lambs among wolves. It's worse than you thought. Therefore, don't take any money, don't take a backpack full of supplies, don't take any shoes. And this isn't Ohio, Kentucky dirt, by the way, you know, soft, rich soil, grass between your toes. This is Israel. Snakes, scorpions, rocks like razor blades. Don't wear shoes. Just get going. Why in the world would he do that? It's because he's trying to train them to get used to never having what they need, ever. when they follow him. See, in your life, the situation God's calling you to, the place he's saying, step into my wisdom, as simple as it may be, you will not have what you need. When he says it's time to go, you'll look around and go, I don't have everything. And he'll say, that's cool, let's go, let's roll. And if in that moment you try to say to him, God, I don't have the money it would take to fix this situation, he'll say, that's okay.